Well, hello to everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Environmental Management of Clostridium difficile. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to thank you all for joining us. Now, for this teleclass, we have registrations from every continent right around the globe, and from north of the Arctic Circle in Canada and Sweden to the southern tip of Argentina and New Zealand. Welcome to you all. I can think of two reasons why this teleclass is so popular. Of course, it is a very important and very timely topic, but I think it's also because we have a very important speaker. Dr. Lynn C. Hulster spends most of her time in Clostridium difficile, figuratively speaking, of course, and in the decontamination of healthcare environments. Dr. C. Hulster is with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And if you've heard any of her teleclasses in past years, you'll know why the next hour will be time very well spent indeed. Before I turn everything over to Dr. C. Hulster, let me take a moment to thank the sponsor for this teleclass, Virox Technologies. Virox has provided moral support and some measure of financial support to the teleclass education program from the very beginning, and I'm pleased to note them as sponsor of today's teleclass as well. To everyone at Virox Technologies, thank you very much indeed. So to bring us to teleclass, Environmental Management of Clostridium difficile from the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, it is my pleasure to present my friend, the incomparable Dr. Lynn C. Hulster. Lynn.
Oh, good heavens, Paul. You do me too good of an honor. Good day to everybody. I'm shocked and surprised we have all continents represented today. That's wonderful. Slide one, I guess, is our title slide, and that is probably up on your screen at the moment. Let's move to slide two. Slide two basically just takes care of an administrative detail. And while I'm at it, to share with you a nice electron micrograph of vegetative C. difficile bacteria, which was prepared by colleagues here in the laboratories here at CDC. They do good work with their electron microscopy, and we're very proud of them. Slide three lists the subtopics I'd like to briefly discuss with you today. I would first like to give you an overview of recently emerging epidemic strains of C. difficile, because if you haven't already, you will continue to hear more and more of these associated with significant outbreaks of Clostridium difficile-associated disease, the acronym for that being CDAD. And the second half of my presentation will consist of a brief review of the medical literature on the environmental infection control for C. difficile, the emphasis being management of predominantly the housekeeping surfaces. I should also point out that I will not be addressing the cleaning and disinfection of invasive medical instruments and devices such as endoscopes. And the principal reason for taking this approach is that high-level disinfectants, the liquid chemical sterilants, and current sterilization methods are all supported in literature and with many years of epidemiology as adequate methods for the inactivation of C. difficile. So we won't go there. Instead, we'll look at the housekeeping. Okay, in slide four, we've listed some of the high points or maybe the low points with C. difficile and the infections that it causes. This spore-forming anaerobic bacterial pathogen can colonize the large intestine, and if some facilitating factors are present, C. difficile can cause a spectrum of intestinal disease ranging in severity from repeated episodes of diarrhea to pseudomembranous colitis, sepsis, and death. It is because of this disease spectrum that we use the acronym CDAD or CDAD to stand for C. difficile-associated disease. This agent is the leading cause of nosocomial diarrhea in healthcare today, accounting for some 15% to 25% of nosocomial antibiotic-associated diarrhea. One of the major risk factors important for colonization is the suppression of the gut's normal flora via the use of antibiotic therapy. Historically, penicillin therapy was commonly associated with this problem, and more recently, the use of the fluoroquinolones is encountered. Once the normal flora of the intestine is suppressed, C. difficile can exploit this imbalance and proliferate. The organism is spread through fecal-oral transmission, and large numbers of organisms are shed in the stool. If the vegetative form of the organism is initially present in stool, it will soon sporulate in the aerobic environment. Contamination has been identified in environmental surfaces, medical devices, and the hands of patients and healthcare workers. We will touch on this a bit later. No pun intended. No, well, okay, maybe the pun was intended. In slide 5, we have a diagram of the general progression of infection from the facilitating risk factor, pictured here as antibiotic therapy, to the appearance of disease. Colonic injury and inflammation are the result of the production of two exotoxins designated A and B. We have determined that these are the primary virulence factors. C. difficile strains that do not produce these toxins are considered non-pathogenic. And toxin B is associated with the development of pseudomembranous colitis. In slide 6, this graph depicts the trend in annual CDAD rates for large U.S. hospitals that conducted intensive care unit surveillance for what used to be known as the NIS surveillance, the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System. This is a voluntary reporting system. This upward trend, however, is not unique to the larger hospitals as we see in the graph for slide 7. This slide depicts the proportion of hospital discharges for various U.S. hospitals of various bed size, with C. difficile listed as any diagnosis as per ICD-9 coding. The source of the discharge data is the National Hospital Discharge Survey. Similar trends are noted, and the rates don't seem to differ much among hospitals of different sizes. In slide 8, we separate out the incidence rates of cases with Clostridium difficile-associated disease as the primary diagnosis from the larger group of any diagnosis where C. difficile infection was mentioned. And you'll see, again, those rates do tend to increase with time, and they continue to increase. We have data not graphed at this point that shows the trend is continuing. In slide 9, we present discharge rates in U.S. hospitals by patient age group. It's quite clear that the elderly sustain significant morbidity with Clostridium difficile-associated disease, and in 2003, their discharge rate per 100,000 population with any diagnosis associated with C. difficile was 7 times higher compared to that for younger adult patients. Advanced age is a known risk factor for Clostridium-associated disease, in addition to antibiotic usage and exposure. Other major risk factors include gastrointestinal surgery or manipulation, a long length of stay in healthcare settings, serious underlying illness, including immunocompromising conditions. In slide 10, the good news or the bad news is that the U.S. is not alone in its increasing incidence of Clostridium difficile-associated disease. In slide 10, data is depicted, compiled from the Health Protection Agency in the U.K. that confirms the disease problem among the elderly, for whom the annual age-specific rate is almost 20 times greater compared to that for patients aged 45 through 64 years. And in slide 11, the upward trend in Clostridium difficile-associated disease incidence is also evident in the UK. This is an upward trend over the past 10 or so years, with some 48,850 reports of positive laboratory cultures reported in 2005, representing a 13.5% increase overall compared to the number of positive cultures in 2004. Recently, an email network informal survey among infectious disease physicians here in the U.S. revealed that some 30-40% of respondents reported increases in the incidence of Clostridium-associated disease in their facilities, but also that the severity of the disease had markedly increased. What were the underlying reasons for these observations? Well, in slide 12, we list some of the possibilities. It is change in host susceptibility, changes in antibiotic prescription practices, changes in infection control procedures, or a change in the organism. While it's possible that each of these contributes to the overall changing picture of Clostridium difficile-associated disease, there is one that clearly has both the infectious disease and the infection control communities worried. In slide 13, recent outbreaks of Clostridium-associated disease in both the U.S. and Canadian healthcare facilities upon investigation have been linked to the emergence of what are considered to be epidemic strains of Clostridium difficile. These strains are clearly distinguishable by molecular typing techniques from historical strains isolated in the 1980s and the 1990s. In many instances in the literature, you will see one of these typical strains identified as strain J. Two major differences noted with the epidemic strains are the deletion of a short DNA segment belonging to the TDC capital C gene, which is part of the regulatory mechanism for toxin production, and carriage of a binary toxin gene, CDTB. More research is needed to be done on these strains to determine what the role of some of these new developments will be, and particularly, we are interested to see what the role of the binary toxin is in the pathogenesis of Clostridium difficile and its associated disease. In slide 14, as I mentioned earlier, outbreaks attributed to epidemic strains of Clostridium difficile have been identified in the U.S. and Canada, and now in other countries as well. Initially, CDC received reports of infection due to epidemic strains in six states, but the number of states reporting positive cultures of epidemic strains has increased now to 22 states. Almost half of our country is now reporting episodes of disease attributed to the epidemic strain. As mentioned earlier, Canada has had a new emerging problem with these agents. A large outbreak in Montreal in eastern Canada a few years ago was attributed to the emergence of these epidemic strains. In slide 15, a graph that depicts key molecular differences between previous strains of C. difficile and emerging epidemic strains. Among these differences are a difference that we see in what we call toxinotyping. Earlier strains were typically identified as being toxinotype 0, and some of the emerging epidemic strains initially have toxinotype 3, and some in other outbreaks here in the States have been identified as toxinotype 9, 14, and 15. You will probably see in the literature a fair amount of emphasis put on toxinotype 3, as this has been one which has been noted in a number of major outbreaks. A second item that is different is a key pulse field gel electrophoresis pattern that clearly distinguishes earlier strains from the epidemic strain. And this strain is currently identified in the literature as North American PFG or Pattern 1. NAP1 is the acronym you'll see in the literature. And more epidemic strains will display that particular pattern, whereas much, much less than 80% of the strains in previous outbreaks are related at all to the NAP1. And as mentioned earlier, the emergence of this binary toxin, this is a factor that we have yet to determine its contribution in overall virulence of C. diff. It is found commonly now in the epidemic strains. Sometimes you will see concurrently that short deletion, an 18 base pair deletion in the gene TCD capital C, again, which is thought to be a regulatory gene governing the production of toxin in cells in the vegetative state. One of the other areas of concern is depicted in slide 16, and that is The epidemic strains of Clostridium difficile seem to be very efficient producers of the toxins A and B. And in this graph that we show is a depiction of the profile during growth, the log growth and stationary phases, comparing the epidemic strain, again, NAP1, toxinotype being toxinotype 3, compared to earlier strains, which were toxinotype 0. And you'll see there's quite a remarkable increase in the production of toxin A. Much of the work today has noted that the production of the toxin tends to take place primarily in the log growth phase, the life cycle, as it were, of the bacteria. And the levels tend to increase slightly and table off there in the stationary phase of growth. So much of the production is during the active growth phase of the bacterium. What is alarming in today's epidemiology is that the toxin levels for A and B are much, much higher than in previous strains. In toxin A, we see in many instances an increase of some 16-fold compared to the levels in previous non-epidemic strains. And in slide 17, we see the same picture, an increased level of toxin B production. In this instance, the levels are much higher. The levels are some 25 times the level that is currently encountered in the non-epidemic strains. Again, much of the production of toxin B occurs during the log growth phase. And as we say, since toxins A and B are the primary virulence factors for Clostridium difficile, with high levels of toxin B, one might expect increases in the occurrence of disease identified as pseudomembranous colitis, in that toxin B has historically been associated as one virulence factor commonly seen with these disease conditions. Now, interestingly, with all the potential for different strains in the community and in our healthcare facilities, and with different levels of toxin in the bacteria these days, I think you'll see a greater divergence and diversity of cases attributed to Clostridium difficile infection. And for that matter, in the States, one would suggest that it's time to make a consistent approach to defining the various diseases associated with C. difficile infection for surveillance purposes. And in slide 18, this is a slide that summarizes a recent publication in the journal Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology. Here at CDC, we're recommending that facilities adopt a consistent approach to defining these cases. In this slide 18, for example, we define what we consider to be a Clostridium difficile associated disease case patient, the initial presentation. We also define a recurrent case with repeated episodes within 8 weeks of each other, and something to quantify severe disease, which is associated with admission to an intensive care unit, for surgical procedures such as a colectomy, or an outcome with death within 30 days post-onset. The article from which this slide was derived goes into a lot more detail because obviously there will be some disagreement and divergence of opinion as to what constitutes, say, cases within each of the definitions. But one thing is very clear. Some of the outbreaks of the epidemic strains recently here in the U.S. have been considered to have been acquired from community sources as opposed to from nosocomial sources. And so another reason for calling for some standardization for surveillance purposes of C. difficile-associated disease is that we need to distinguish where these infections are initially acquired. Once we can determine the contribution of community-associated disease to the overall picture, I think we'll have a better understanding of the natural history of this disease and a better understanding of the overall epidemiology of the disease. Okay. Well, that's a very, very brief overview of the glooming picture we have before us with epidemic Clostridium difficile. So at this point, it makes sense to move on to some of the things we need to do to control the spread of this organism to other patients and healthcare workers. And as the title of the presentation notes, we will spend the vast majority of our time looking at some environmental issues and not so much instrument or device issues. In slide 19, we start with the environmental infection control part of the presentation. And I think the first question to be asked is, what surfaces and objects tend to become contaminated in the healthcare setting with Clostridium difficile? These next three slides, starting with slide 19, highlight three studies that were done in various settings, and I think they show a consistent pattern which you would find repeated in other studies that are in the literature as well. I think we expect surfaces that come in contact with fecal matter in areas housing Clostridium difficile-associated disease patients to be contaminated with C. difficile spores. Additionally, it may be logical to assume that surfaces in the immediate vicinity of fecal matter cleanup procedures and toilet flushing may also become contaminated if these procedures produce what we'll call fine mist aerosols capable of distributing spore contamination to the floors and the equipment in that immediate area. In slide 20, we have another study, this done in the Chicago area here in the U.S., and there are three points to be made from the observations in this study. The first is the positive correlation between the number of Clostridium difficile-associated disease patients and the extent of environmental contamination. Follows the more C. difficile-associated disease patients on the ward, the greater the extent of contamination. Second, contamination of the environment is not simply or automatically associated with the presence of an infected or colonized patient. In the phase of the study at Cook County Hospital, for example, the epidemic strain of C. difficile was detected a month after the index patient was identified. Third point is that the use of communal medical devices, such as rectal thermometers, or in this case, blood pressure cuffs, can serve as fomites to spread contamination. Discontinuing their communal use and going with patient-specific items is one possible control measure. And new technologies for devices that measure temperature can enhance isolation practices and limit the patient-to-patient transferal of infectious microorganisms. In slide 21, this is a slide that depicts a study done in two geriatric wards by Dr. Mark Wilcox and his colleagues there in Leeds in the United Kingdom. The type and proportion of C. difficile contaminated surfaces in these wards corroborate the observations of the study cited in this presentation and similar studies in the literature. The points illustrated here are, interestingly, that floors and rooms with toilets and the areas where bedpans and commodes are cleaned tend to be more heavily contaminated compared to floors elsewhere on the ward. The second point, objects that may not be touched frequently and are not in the vicinity of the contaminated aerosols tend to show limited contamination. And third, surfaces and equipment that are touched either by the patients or the healthcare workers can become extensively contaminated. Encouraging a campaign to promote good hand washing practices for patients and healthcare workers can help to minimize the problem that is associated with frequently touched surfaces. So I think we see a fairly consistent pattern in our healthcare facilities of where we might encounter spore contamination, and it will be following logically those areas where you have the greatest potential for fecal contamination to occur. The tracking of spores throughout the ward could possibly happen with spores identified on shoes of healthcare workers, but again, you have to ask the question of how does contamination on the floors contribute directly to transmission of disease among patients, and that answers that question is not easily answered. Probably more easy to determine is, again, the opportunities for hand transferal of the organism, and that is why in so many instances we focus on frequently touched surfaces in strategies for environmental control. So we've established that we have the opportunity for environmental surfaces to have spore contamination. Ultimately, these may serve as reservoirs for contaminating other sites or patients and healthcare workers. And we've also obviously known we've got the problem with bacterial spore. So the logical assumption is if we are using a chemical or a detergent to serve as an environmental control factor, we're going to have to find something that can deal with the problem of the spores. So that means something that has some sporicidal properties. In slide 22, we have some work that I've highlighted from researchers Young and Setlow, albeit this is work that was done with spores of Bacillus subtilis. I think the reason why I'm highlighting these is because this is a study they had done to look at the sporicidal properties of oxidative chemicals. What is it about a spore that creates such high levels of intrinsic resistance to germicides? And I think in this instance, we can look at the biochemical and biophysical properties of spores. Interestingly, some researchers basically have described that dormancy in and of itself is a resistance factor. And the reason why these things are dormant is because when in a hostile environment, the vegetative cell starts to go in a different pathway, somewhat dismantling itself and hunkering down for the long haul, with very limited metabolic processes and synthesis of chemicals in a core, in a membrane, in a spore wall or a spore coat that can be very resistant to the activity of a number of germicides. But I think the biophysical, biochemical properties are important to examine so you can determine what you need to inactivate spores. And in slide 23, we list some of the findings that Young and Setlow had found with Bacillus subtilis in determining what it was about the spore inactivation process that was achieved with the use of oxidative chemicals. They found that oxidative chemicals acted upon the spore inner membrane and disrupted and damaged this component of the spore. And ultimately, some of the consequences of this site of activation resulted in the ability to damage the spore and interfere with its germinating processes. And so consequently, when they looked at Bacillus subtilis spores exposed to solutions with hypochlorite ions, they found that for this particular organism, the spores were unable to germinate at all. So the process of germination was interrupted from the beginning. When you look at the exposure of the spores to chlorine dioxide, the interruption of germination was perhaps slightly different in that they found that B. subtilis spores were able to germinate or at least start the germination process. But at some point, this is aborted because the spore is damaged in a way that can no longer support the completion of the germination process. So basically what we have is spores that are still present in organic matter, but they can't do anything. And so if they can't achieve the vegetative phase of the organism again, then things are not going to go anywhere. So that's, in essence, what we're doing when we're inactivating spores is we're, by and large, and at least for Bacillus subtilis, we're preventing them from germinating and taking on a new round of active growth in the proper host disease and infection production. In slide 24, this is a slide depicting a laboratory study performed by colleagues Dr. Perez and Dr. Saeed Sattar's laboratory. And this study examined the potency of several, again, several oxidative chemicals. Most of the, I believe all of these, have either chlorine-containing or, again, are an activated hydrogen peroxide. It's interesting that this is, again, a laboratory-based study using numbers of spores that would greatly exceed what we normally would expect, say, contaminated surfaces in healthcare. In essence, what studies like this and others do is look at the absolute worst cases in terms of available bioburden and see what the effects are with different chemicals when the chemicals are applied to contaminated carriers containing, in this instance, a defined number of spores. Now, I should mention at this point, I have this slide and a few others that will use the trade names of proprietary products. But as many of you know, CDC, we usually do the disclaimer that these are used primarily for identification purposes only and that they're not really intended as endorsement or a specific recommendation for a proprietary product. Another housekeeping point I have to get across. There are several products of various concentrations, some of which have differing levels of free chlorine, such as the different dilutions of sodium hypochlorite or the bleach as identified in the last three bars there on the right. And what this study did was to compare the results from chlorine dioxide, an activated hydrogen peroxide product, and the product where bleach was acidified through the addition of acetic acid, and then three different dilutions of more traditional sodium hypochlorite concentrated solutions. For example, the bleach that is identified in the item, the third group from the right, is what we would consider and that you would see typically in healthcare identified as a 1 to 10 dilution of bleach that is typically manufactured in the States where the starting percentage of hypochlorite is in the range of 5 to 6%. Several of the products from this particular slide show a great deal of sporicidal activity capable of producing 6-log reductions in spores in times sometimes as short as maybe 2 or 3 minutes. In other instances, you will see contact time needed up to 30 minutes in order to achieve the 6-log reduction. I think these are, for some of the products that are showing a 6-log reduction, the time frame is well within contact times that are commonly used in healthcare. But one thing to note, as a result of some of these studies, both Dr. Perez and Dr. Sattar have made note that the use of these chemicals is not considered a benign thing to do, and that with the higher chlorine concentrations, especially with the 1 to 10 sodium hypochlorite or acidified bleach, you do have the potential for the release of chlorine gas during their use. And this is noted to be a occupational hazard for the healthcare workers and a safety hazard for the patients in the areas where these chemicals are used. So I think if you look at that particular paper, you will see their advice that these chemicals be used on really more of an as-needed basis rather than using them routinely either throughout the hospital or after a problem with continued transmission of Clostridium difficile-associated disease is concerned. So I think that is a point that we should take note of and be mindful of that as we devise our environmental strategies. In slide 25, this is another study that was done from Dr. Bloch's laboratory in Israel, looking at the potencies of two other disinfectant products. One has an equivalency to peracetic acid at 0.26% concentration, and the other, let's see if I can pronounce this, this is a sodium diisocyanurate. It's was studied at a concentration of 1,000 milligrams per liter and is considered as a chlorine-releasing agent. You sometimes see this as in detergents and sometimes in other products as a kind of a standalone active ingredient. One thing I think you can note from these two graphs is certainly the longer the contact time, the greater the opportunity to inactivate more pathogens. Whether this contact time can be of a practical matter, certainly if you eliminate much of the bioburden with cleaning, then in some instances you can look at perhaps a shorter contact time with a strong chemical. One thing to note, however, is that the y-axis for these two graphs is not exactly the same. On the left, we have a greater proportion of reduction with the observation for the chemicals for spores on stainless steel compared to the observation of spores being inactivated on a polymer, a plastic polymer that was consistent with some flooring material. The lesson, I think, from this is that it pays to pay strict attention to the manufacturer's use conditions of chemical products, because there may be differing use conditions depending upon the intended use of the product. For example, if you are using them on smooth surfaces like stainless steel, you could potentially have a contact time that could be definitely shorter than if you were using them on perhaps a surface that might be textured or not be as easy to clean as a smooth, hard surface. So the take-home lesson here is to look closely at the manufacturer's recommendations, as there may be some differences in use conditions. And cleaning is the subject of slide 26. This is more data from Dr. Wilcox's laboratory, where they looked at the ability of the organism to convert to spores in the presence or in a hostile environment, in this case, in the presence of what is called sub-inhibitory concentrations of various cleaners and disinfectants. This particular study looked at the sporulation ability of three isolates, one of which was an environmental isolate, at least C. difficile isolated from an environmental source, and two others from clinical specimens. The isolates were then prepared in fecal emulsions, thus giving an environment where you might anticipate these to be present in the environment, but also with the fecal emulsion to offer perhaps some measure of protection to the microorganisms. This fecal emulsion was then exposed to different chemicals, disinfecting and detergents, and then the results were expressed as essentially the numbers, percentage of spores that were visible in microscopic fields. And what they found was that if you are using chlorine-containing compounds, you will have fewer spores present compared to the observations noted for compounds that were not chlorine-containing. And again, one thing that is somewhat troubling is the fact that of the isolates, the environmental isolate and the clinical isolate, the one identified as P24, P24 was identified as an epidemic strain. And so this is also especially troubling, not only for the fact that epidemic strains seem to do much more efficient toxin production, but they also seem to produce more spores. They sporulate more efficiently compared to clinical isolates that are not derived from an epidemic strain. So you have the potential for greater spore contamination when you are dealing with patients who have the epidemic strain. And interestingly, the epidemic strain outproduced spores compared to the production of spores from the environmental strain. Now, you would expect the environmental strain to be an efficient spore producer, simply because it's an environmental strain. It's kind of grown up in the environment of harsh conditions, and so it's going to be more effective in converting itself to spores compared to, say, a clinical isolate, which is patient-derived and not nearly as conditioned to a harsh environment. So cleaning is important. The choice of cleaners is important. The take-home lesson from Dr. Wilcox's work is that it is probably going to be a good idea if, say, as your cleaner is used, that it has some chlorine in the formulation. And I understand that there are a number of products on the market, at least in the U.S., that are either a chlorine-based cleaner disinfectant or a cleaner with some chlorine properties. One thing I noted when looking at some of the papers that described outbreaks and the control measures that were used, when they made the point that, oh my gosh, this has got to be an environmental problem, and they go through the litany of here's what we did, the thing that seems to be, in my opinion, oversimplified is what exactly did you do for the environmental strategy? You find that many of the papers will talk about, oh, well, we increased the frequency of cleaning, or we converted to, say, an oxidative chemical, and that's about as far as it goes. It's very, very unusual to find a paper that really gives you details of what you do. For example, were the chemicals used correctly for full contact time? Did you rinse the surfaces? Were the chemicals applied with cloth, or did you freshly mix up chemicals for spray application? I think a lot of these little details are helpful to publish and would help our colleagues to better understand what goes into an environmental strategy and what we need to do to make an effective strategy. In slide 28, one thing that I didn't really spend a great deal of time is hand washing. I think we've heard over and over and over again the importance of hand washing, and I can't really do any better than what has already been said. We got to wash our hands. We've got to do it consistently. We have to do it effectively. It is the most important thing we can do to prevent the transfer of organisms from one point to another. Historically, we have done hand washing throughout healthcare. More recently has been the adoption and widespread use of the antimicrobial hand products, the hand rubs, the foams, the gels, and whatnot. This, I think, presents an interesting problem, per se. In slide 29, these are the indications for hand hygiene as come from the guidance produced by the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, the federal advisory committee that we work with here at CDC. And as you can see, if you have hands visibly dirty, contaminated, or soil, then you are washing with a soap, either non-antimicrobial or an antimicrobial soap and water. If hands are not visibly soiled, then you can use, in this case, alcohol hand products for routine decontamination of the hands. However, given that many laboratories will store spore crops in alcohol, it follows that alcohol is not going to be an effective product for hand hygiene use in areas especially where you have an ongoing problem of Clostridium difficile transmission. And so therefore, it's prudent to go back to the good old hand washing techniques with either an antimicrobial or a non-antimicrobial soap. The point is, in this case, instead of trying to inactivate spores, you are physically removing them from the hands. There is some benefit to some of the old traditional methods. In slide 30, we have a graph showing the results from what was a multi-factor approach to infection control in a hospital here in the States, I believe in Alabama. This was done over a 10-year period several years ago. Now, it's interesting because they had increasing levels of Clostridium-associated disease for many years, took this intervention step with the steps that are listed on the left-hand side of the slide. And as you can see, the results show a decrease in the incidence of Clostridium-associated disease. One thing to note is that when they began their study, they were using a phenolic as a disinfectant. And it would be interesting to see what happens in this facility in more contemporary times, since phenolics are tending to be phased out for general use. You still find them for some applications, but they're not as used widespread as they once were. So I think it would be good to revisit that facility and see what's going on. But I think the clear message here is by a adherence to a multifactorial program for intervention, you can receive and get some very good reductions in your incidence levels in your facility. Well, having said all that, the next few slides are some summary slides, and most of these you can read at your leisure, and they do tend to repeat each other. So the good news is that I think we are being consistent in our recommendations around the world. This first slide, number 31, is live material that comes from Canada, and this appears from a document that was published from an advisory group there out of Toronto, Canada. One thing you'll note is there is going to be some difference of opinion on some of the large housekeeping surfaces like the floors. And I think there's also differences in approach whether a group wants to do more of a detergent-based approach to cleaning versus others which will rely more heavily on disinfection. So there is some variability, and there may be good reasons for this. I think, in general, the guidance from all three countries, the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom, is reasonably similar. In slide 32, this hits the high points of guidance from the U.K. This came from the Department of Health. Stay on this slide for a minute, but the next slide shows some additional guidance and the internet resources that I tapped into to find these other documents. But in this slide, number 32, I think it's interesting that the group has kept the door open for either new technologies or new chemicals as they come out of the research and development arena and are now moving into mainstream use. I think with the UK guidance, there is that flexibility to adopt other chemicals as research shows their value, and I think this is worthwhile to consider for other guidance documents as well. Slide 33, as I mentioned, has some other guidance material from the UK. In slide 34, these are the guidance statements from here in the Centers for Disease Control. Again, very close and similar to those of our cousins. The important thing is that we should remind people that the control measures for proper antibiotic therapy, proper use of contact precautions, and hand washing will probably have much more of an impact than environmental measures per se. I think environmental measures can contribute to the overall prevention of Clostridium difficile disease, but it's down on the scale of impact compared to proper antibiotic therapy approaches and contact precautions and hand washing. In slide 35, well, I do have to put in a plug for a document that I grew up with, and basically to say that there's a lot of this discussion and information in the CDC's what I call the Environmental Infection Control Guideline. That was released in 2003, and as you may guess, there's been a great deal of literature released since then, especially dealing with the epidemic strains. And if you are interested in slide 36, this is where you can access that guidance document from CDC. It is available either as an online document, or if you're like me and like something hard to hold in your hand, you can order a print version from the American Society for Healthcare Engineering. Well, to close this presentation, what's the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency up to these days? because they certainly have a hand in this discussion since they are the ones that are the regulatory agency here in the U.S. that's the gatekeeper, in a sense, of the legal marketing of disinfectants. They are aware that currently there are no registered sporicides available for environmental or housekeeping surface treatments. And to that note, they are working in 2007 to try and develop new guidelines so that manufacturers can move forward with disinfectant label claims against C. difficile spores. So stay tuned, and we'll see what the EPA releases later this year or early next year. In slide 38, I just want to show my appreciation to Dr. Cliff McDonald. He's my colleague and my boss here at the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, to share with me his slides on the epidemiology of the epidemic strains. But equally as important are the many colleagues in healthcare and research around the world. We feel their work brings us a greater understanding of this healthcare problem, helping us to refine our current work strategies and exploring new possibilities for infection control. Well, thank you again. You've all been a very wonderful and attentive audience, and I'll turn the program back to Paul Weber.
Thank you very much, Lynn. I'm really grateful to you for preparing and presenting this teleclass. I know there was a lot of extra work in there and a lot of stuff going on at the CDC that's been distracting you as well. I'm glad you're able to get this to us. Is there any evidence or are there any reports about Clostridium difficile in a biofilm? A lot of the places where you said C. diff is found tend to be fairly damp areas.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence of increased resistance of either bacterial spores or the vegetative C. diff in biofilms in these areas?
I've not seen reports that specifically look at this, but I think that's an intriguing concept. And we do have some folks here at CDC who do biofilm work, and there's an excellent possibility that they may be looking into this as we speak. As you might guess, biofilms would probably still be aerobic, and so if we do see Clostridium difficile at presence there, I'm thinking we would probably see spores which would be acquiescent or quiescent in that environment until a better environment comes along.
Before I close, I would also like to say, as Dr. C. Helster did, that a mention of a company or brand name during the course of any teleclass should not be taken as an endorsement. Teleclass Education does not endorse or advertise any product or company. Thanks again to Virox Technologies for their sponsorship of this teleclass. Thank you, Lynn and Dr. C. Helster, for another outstanding teleclass presentation. And thank you to all of you for your participation and your attention and your support of teleclass education. Until we meet again, goodbye.